Coming up on Weekend America.
The Miss America pageant is an American tradition, but not always a beloved one.
The whole idea of that Miss America, who got up on the stage and said, "All I want to be is a wife and mother," it just got to me.
A look back at Miss America 1968. I'm John Moe. Also, there's a clear path to ending our reliance on foreign oil, at least according to this one guy in New Jersey.
We don't have an energy crisis. We have an energy equipment crisis. All the energy you want is there for the taking. Solar, wind, tidal.
Of course, he's not just any guy. He built a power plant in his garage. Also generating energy in the home, kids and caffeine.
I'm scared of falling asleep.
I'm not falling asleep.
Does anybody drive my
face? Oh, do you
have
Coke?
Coffee, cappuccino, anything?
Reports from a slumber party that's way more party than slumber. Weekend America, after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe in St. Paul. It's amazing to me that adults don't appreciate what it's like to be a kid. Because they should. Every adult is a former kid. The memories are recorded. So I don't get it when adults talk about how simple a kid's life is. It's not simple. Yeah, there are no bills or tough times at work, but you still have to navigate these amazingly complicated social situations and without any accumulated wisdom to do so because you're a kid. This hour, we go behind the scenes at two sleepovers. Unnerving. One for boys, one for girls. You will be enlightened. You will be uncomfortable. What do you remember of sleepovers?
Eat junk food and watch movies and stay up way too late.
Pillow fight, truth or dare.
We would giggle a lot.
Maybe do a little artwork.
Play a lot of music and pull pranks.
They put whipped cream in each other's hands, then tickle them awake so they get whipped cream all over the place. They put hands in water so they pee themselves while they're sleeping. It's torture.
We used to wait until my mom went to bed and streak in the neighborhood. Yes, that was a popular sleepover activity at my house.
Man, terrifying. Those voices came from Washington, D.C., Concord, New Hampshire, and Portland, Oregon. In Las Vegas, it's the annual Miss America pageant this weekend. Wait, didn't that used to be in Atlantic City? Yes, it did. It also used to emphasize swimsuits, cheesecake, and now it's supposedly all about scholarships, but still kind of about cheesecake, let's be honest. The point is, it evolves. It's changed, like America. At the 1968 competition, outside Atlantic City's Convention Hall, a group of women gathered on the boardwalk. They held signs that read Women's Liberation. Their demonstration caught the attention of the nation and was a window into the emergence of a movement that would gain considerable strength in the decade to come.
Well, 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 will you look at those lovely creatures? Look at that one. As tasty and tempting and toothsome and trim and tiny a tidbit. Now, say beautiful, let me in on the secret.
My name is Jackie Ceballos. I'm the founder and the president of Veteran Feminists of America. I went to college and I majored in music. I went to New York and I married a dashing Colombian and had a wonderful, exciting life. Lived within Colombia with maids, started an opera company. But when push came to shove, I was a woman and my husband was very upset with what I was doing. And a friend came and she just handed me Betty Friedan's book, The Feminine Mystique. I read it. And that was it. I started plodding my way back to New York to work in the movement.
We're gonna have all our sisters here to come and join the fight.
1967 now started. I joined Now.
National organization for women.
And then we started hearing about these radical feminists across town.
I'm Kathy Sarah Child. Back in 1968, I was Kathy Amatnick.
There were younger women who had come out of the SDS and the Young People's Movement, and they had fought with the guys who were treating them like slaves.
We thought in terms of liberation.
They wanted to change the world. That's why they said, we don't want women's rights. We want women's liberation, you know.
We used to have what were called consciousness-raising sessions, and I think we were watching a movie about beauty contests.
And now, the time for official judging has finally arrived.
Then we went around the room talking about how beauty contests actually affected our lives.
The judging is by points. So much for appearance in an evening gown. So many points for figure in a bathing suit.
A very dear friend of mine, Carol Hanisch, in high school and probably even earlier, watching the Miss America pageant on television had been a very important part of her life. She used to say, I cried with the winner.
There she is, Miss America.
Carol had this idea of, my gosh, that's the symbol of everything, the Miss America pageant. That should be our first major public action, protesting the Miss America pageant.
The whole idea of that Miss America, who got up on the stage and said, all I want to be is a wife and mother, it just got to me. And when I heard that they were going to the Miss America pageant, I wanted to be on board.
And starring 50 of America's loveliest young ladies, the charming and talented girls competing for the title of Miss America 1968.
My name is Deborah Barnes Snodgrass.
Deborah Dean Barnes.
And I was Miss America in 1968.
Miss Kansas formerly, now Miss America.
We were goal-oriented, education-oriented young women that were there to get scholarship money. Talent being 50% of the points when we competed.
It's always a treat to bring you the talent competition. Whatever their performance, our top 10 are always a joy to behold.
My talent for the competition was my own arrangement of Born Free, a piano solo. I actually did not win the talent competition. Miss Indiana won, and she was an Olympic ice skater. They made an ice rink about the size of my living room, which is pretty small, and she did such awesome tricks. But I won swimsuit. That's hard to believe.
And what are the judges thinking?
I tried to forget what I was wearing and just look at the people and have a good time. But I was uncomfortable wearing a swimsuit. The first week of September in 1968, I gave up my crown, which means I crowned my successor, Judy Ford. My duties were to be available for the contestants and also to make my going away speech. During that week, the Women's Liberation Movement were demonstrating outside the convention hall where Miss America pageant was held.
Yes, sirree, boys, step right up. How much am I offered for that number one piece of prime American property?
Many of us had become conscious of the effect that beauty standards have and dress codes, how that cut into our daily lives and freedom.
Listen, I was considered very pretty when I was in college, and I want to tell you that the main thing in my day, which don't forget, was in the 1940s, was who was the prettiest girl in the family? Who was the prettiest girl in school? It was unbelievable.
We had something called the Freedom Trash Can.
I was told to bring something oppressive to women.
At first, we were going to burn all these instruments of female torture.
But we were not allowed to make a fire. So the story that we burned our bras is wrong. So what we did was we walked around. There were, I think, maybe 50, 75 of us.
Everybody was lined up to throw something in and explain what they hated about it.
The young women had thrown away their bras. I never stopped wearing a bra, by the way, because I'm a size 36 something, whatever, and a bra is more comfortable.
And it wasn't just bras. Bras was, in a way, the least of the problem. There were high heels we were throwing in there.
And I threw my 16-year-old son's Playboy magazines in. Playboy, with their boobs hanging out and all. I thought it was really anti-woman, really. I still do.
We we had prepared songs.
Wonderful songs to other tunes, you know.
There's some songs we soon came to regard as anti-woman, like Ain't She Sweet.
Ain't She Sweet. Making profit off her meat. Beauty sells, she's told, so she's out plugging it. Ain't she sweet?
Look her over once or twice. I ask you confidentially, ain't she nice?
Just the fact that this group of women would say to us who were in the pageant competing that we were selling ourselves. And it was almost verging upon prostitution. It did really hurt my feelings because I felt that my femininity was something to be respected and to be celebrated.
We also planned, as part of the protest, going inside the pageant.
Live from Convention Hall in Atlantic City, the Miss America pageant.
We all dressed up in high heels and gorgeous dresses to get inside. We went up into the balcony.
Now, let us give one final salute to Miss America of 1968.
When Miss America was marching down to, here she is, Miss America, what is it? They unfurled this huge banner.
And then they started shouting during my going away speech.
And shouted, women's liberation, no more Miss America.
I really didn't hear what they were saying.
For a split second, you could see the camera stop and everybody look up.
You know, it was not as militant as perhaps it might have been, but we did not resist the police, but we went along with them, and then they shoved us out the side door. And that was it. They just let us go.
I never know how to react to someone who finds out that I've been Miss America and they say, ooh, you were Miss America. I don't know whether they're saying, ew, you were Miss America, or, oh, wow, you were Miss America, because I don't know yet how they feel about the pageant. I know that some of the things that the Women's Liberation Movement accomplished have made way for me to enjoy what I'm enjoying now as a career woman. I know that.
Male chauvinism started collapsing like sandcastles falling apart.
Still, the responsibility of the family care is still falling primarily on women. It's not being shared equally. And that's not what we meant by women's liberation, the double day. Like, we now say, like, equal free time for women and men is as important as equal pay, you know.
So we still have a long ways to go.
That was Jackie Ceballos, Deborah Barnes Snodgrass, and Kathy Sarachild. Our story was produced by Ann Hepperman and Kara Oler with help from Renee Gutel and Missy Beloit. Special thanks to Red Stockings Archives for Action, Third World Newsreel, and Deborah Barnes Snodgrass for the archival sound. Be sure to check out pictures from the protest and the pageant on our website, along with some videos, weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week.
As newspapers lose readers to the internet, one entrepreneur is printing blogs on paper. Is that good news, bad news, or no news? Plus, the inauguration lightning round, next on Weekend America. From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. This was a big news week. We have a new president. He's doing new things. We have a world spinning around and new events are happening all the time. How do you make sense of it? You listen to the radio and you listen to us, and we break things down into categories of good news, bad news, or no news. Here to help us is our panel, radio talk show host Luke Burbank. Hello, Luke.
Hi, John.
Yale University literature professor Amy Hungerford. Hello, Amy.
Hey, John.
And from Reason Magazine, Carrie Howley. Hello, Carrie.
Hi, John.
Topic number one. Let's try a presidential inauguration lightning round. There was so much to take in, so much to try to make sense of during that inauguration. Let's see if we can break it down. To begin with, Chief Justice John Roberts blowing the oath.
Bad news. This is a fairly important moment in American history. Just bring a 3x5 card or write something down on your hand.
Carrie?
Oh, I think it was good news. It was kind of a humanizing moment. You had all of this lavish kind of king-making ceremony, and then this little awkward moment I thought was one of the few moments of interest in the whole thing.
Okay, no harm, no foul, good news. Amy Hungerford.
I'd say bad news because it looked like Obama made the mistake. It took me till the next day in reading the papers to realize that it wasn't Obama.
Amy, I think I need to go to you with this one. The poem read at the inaugural.
My friend Elizabeth's poem was fantastic. Good news.
I think the poem was really bad. And I think it was read in this kind of arch poem voice, which made it worse. So bad news.
I thought good news. For me, this was less a great moment in our nation's history as much as a public speaking competition. And I was just waiting to see who would mess up. She didn't mess up at all. And the poem did not rhyme. And it was not a limerick, which is what I would have written. And so I say good news.
There was no man from Nantucket involved.
That is right. Yeah. That is right.
How about the invocation by the Reverend Joseph Lowry featuring when yella can be mella and when the red man can get a head man?
Good news for rhyme in the ceremony.
Okay.
I say good news. And as I went about my day, as a white, I was much more inclined to do right.
Okay, good. So
it echoed.
All right, topic number two. Saying there's been, quote, too much secrecy in this city, unquote, President Barack Obama reversed a Bush administration policy that made it harder to get information through the Freedom of Information Act. Instead of having to make a case for why information should be made public, the de facto position will now be to make the information public unless a case can be made for secrecy. What kind of news is that?
This is great news, not just sort of symbolically for the openness and transparency of government. It's great news for the economy. This makes jobs for all those scholars. We have plenty to look at, but this means we'll need more scholars.
Oh, good.
Yeah. This is good news.
Good news good for news. Scholars, says the tenured professor.
That's right.
Carrie Howley, what do you think?
I think it's good news. I'm looking forward to the impending declassifications because, you know, there's just so much we don't know about the inner workings of government, like what happened in Roswell and how they faked the moon landing and how they made that naval destroyer invisible. So I'll be looking for answers to all of this at whitehouse.gov.
I definitely say good news. Show me one time when there have been problems because the government has been too transparent with what it's doing, what its thought process is. It seems like every time there's, some kind of major issue, there's an attempt to cover it up. There's all kinds of secrecy. I can't really see what the downside is. Plus, I don't see that many FOIA requests coming from Waziristan. I don't feel like that's how Al-Qaeda is going to get us, is that they're going to go through the proper paperwork channels, learn about some arcane, you know, governmental procedure, and then use it to kick our butts. You know, I mean, I just don't understand what the threat would be of making this information more available. So I'm saying great news.
Let's move on. Big city newspapers are dying and the internet is getting blamed for it. But one entrepreneur is doing things in reverse. Joshua Karp is the publisher of The Printed Blog. First editions appeared in Chicago and San Francisco this week. It's a free printed selection of material originally published online. It's put on dead trees. It's handed out to people. What kind of news is this, especially given the current state of newspapers and the economy and the media?
I think it's bad news. At least for this guy, I think, in terms of a business plan, because the whole reason blogs are tolerable, I think, and I say this as someone who blogs, there's this poorly researched puerile junk that's put up there, which then is very quickly replaced by other poorly researched puerile junk.
Yeah, I write puerile, replaceable things, and I think it's good news. Everyone kind of assumes that people won't read print anymore, but the truth is that printed newspapers have shown very little innovation, especially in the opinion pages. They save risk-taking for their digital editions, and so I'm rooting for the blog purr.
I think people still use the printed page quite differently than they do their electronic devices. Now, some people may be so totally...
Just say it. It's for going in the bathroom.
No, you can take your...
I have been specifically told that I'm not to take my laptop in there by my girlfriend.
Well, you're sitting down, aren't you? You got a lap. I still think that it feels different to read on the printed page for a lot of us. That may not be true for everybody. And we read in different moments of the day. I will not look at a screen while I'm trying to help my daughter do her homework, but I would glance at a paper.
I love the whole kind of retro technology aspect of this. I hope in the same spirit someone decides to create like a Facebook Telegram service or something.
All right, final topic. As the economy worsens, people are traveling less. That means hotels have more vacancies and less money. So according to the Wall Street Journal, they're cutting corners. They're eliminating perks like hand lotion in the room, coffee in the lobby, fruit. They're giving out fewer towels. Is that good news, bad news, or no news?
I think it's good news because I have a very complicated relationship with the freebies that you get at a hotel. It's obsessive compulsive the way that I behave when I get into one of these hotel rooms. I need someone to help me protect myself from myself. Right. And this does that. And since, you know, the world revolves around me, at least in my mind, I think this is good news, John.
Well, you know, you've always had to pay for the in-room porn, so some things don't change. And there are free perks. I mean, you can still jump on the bed. Isn't that the exciting part of staying
That's
in a big hotel when you're little,
really.
Jumping on the bed?
Yeah.
And if there are two beds, that you can jump from one to the other.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Where's the magic now that there's no lotion? Still, as an adult to this day, I go in and I sniff the shampoo to see if it smells different than the one I have and whether I like it or not. So when they came out with like green tea scents that I actually liked, I thought, oh, this is kind of nice. I feel sort of pampered. So, and you know you're there because someone put a little thing of lotion and some differently smelling shampoo on your sink before you got there.
Well, that's the news of the week. Thankfully, now it all makes perfect sense and smells rather nice as well. Panel, thank you.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Luke Burbank is a former National Public Radio reporter. He hosts the radio show Too Beautiful to Live in Seattle. Carrie Howley is contributing editor to Reason magazine. Amy Hungerford is a professor of literature at Yale University.
Weekend America is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This program is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, and KPCC Los Angeles.
A sleepover full of 10-year-old girls. Another sleepover full of 10-year-old boys. We have reporters stationed at both and microphones on. Oh, there are shenanigans ahead on Weekend America.
Thank you.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. President Obama and Congress are hard at work crafting the politics and policy of the proposed $800 billion economic stimulus package this week. Reportedly, $100 billion of that could go to alternative energy and energy efficiency projects, which is really big news to this one guy in New Jersey. He's turned his garage into a hydrogen and solar power plant. As part of our series Garageland, reporter Eugene Son takes us to the first hydrogen solar-powered home in North America.
When you walk up Mike Stritsky's driveway in Hopewell, New Jersey, it doesn't look like the home of a guy who is devoted to renewable energy. The woods surrounding his garage are littered with backhoes, snowmobiles, bulldozers. The roof holds row after row of tidy solar panels. There's a second set parked next to the garage. Stritsky walks around to the other side of the garage to show off the project's centerpiece. There's a white metal case the size of a corner mailbox. Inside, lots of hoses and wires circle the guts of the operation.
Fuel cell stack is right here. You can see all the stacks. You have a thermostat. It's got a regular car radiator in it. And we can use the excess heat from the fuel cell in the winter to heat the garage.
Stritsky's two-bay garage is big enough that you could run a small repair shop in it if it weren't so full of stuff. He's kept the solar panels and the rest of his renewable energy dream in the garage to keep peace with his wife.
The boss says, basically, you know, I can do what I want in my shop, as long as it doesn't affect her shop.
Stritsky calls what he does out here bottling sunshine. His whole house runs off the solar panels. When they create excess electricity, he saves it by running it through an electrolyzer. It uses the energy to split water into hydrogen and oxygen. He stores the hydrogen in 10 1,000-gallon tanks. When the panels aren't producing enough juice, the fuel cell kicks in. Hydrogen gets run through the fuel cell, where it combines with oxygen. The chemical reaction creates electricity all over again. The whole process is run by three laptops sitting on one side of the garage.
Lots of people are making fuel cells, lots of people are making electrolyzers, lots of people are making solar panels and inverters, but no one seemed to be assembling them into the machine.
Making that machine hasn't been cheap. Stritsky put $100,000 of his own money into it. He got $250,000 from the State Board of Public Utilities as a demonstration project. He raised another $200,000 from green technology companies. All told, the garage power plant cost way more than his house. School kids come here all the time to visit the 3,000-square-foot colonial home. Stritsky tells how he stuffed it with as much insulation as possible. He says it uses 60% less energy than a typical home of its size. It still has a pool, hot tub, and big-screen TV. He loves to show visitors his super-efficient appliances that he's converted to run off hydrogen.
These are LG washer and dryers. This uses about 4 gallons of water for 17 pair of jeans. If this were an upright machine, it would use 55 gallons.
Stritsky says it frustrates him to hear renewable energy called too expensive or unreliable. He built his home power plant to prove it can be done right now.
We don't have an energy crisis. We have an energy equipment crisis. All the energy you want is there for the taking. Solar, wind, tidal.
Stritsky says he's sure renewable energy can become commercially viable if it ever escapes its niche market and can take advantage of mass production. As for the $100 billion President Obama is discussing for renewable energy, Stritsky says it could have a huge impact if it's spent the right way. What he doesn't want is money for research. If he were in charge, he would subsidize solar panel production. That could make room for a lot more homes like the one he's built. In Hopewell, New Jersey, I'm Eugene Son for Weekend America.
This spring, Mike Stritsky is hoping to get one of the first commercial fuel cell cars to hit the market. He actually drives a fuel cell car already, one he designed and built when he worked for the State Department of Transportation. But his driving has to be local since the nearest hydrogen fueling station is 100 miles away in White Plains, New York.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
It's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. If you're a kid, weekend entertainment options are limited. Can't drive, got no money, got no freedom. But you can have a sleepover. And the fun of a sleepover is how liberating it is. You stay up late, eat crazy foods, there are pranks. One of our favorite stories on this show aired a couple of years ago. Hillary Frank and Jonathan Menjivar are reporters in Philadelphia. They also happen to be married to each other. They went to two sleepovers on the same night. Hillary with a group of roughly 10-year-old girls, Jonathan with a gang of roughly 10-year-old boys. Tape was rolling.
It's 7 o'clock. Early still. But Bryce says that when you sleep over at his house, you basically sign a contract. You fall asleep first. You're in for a prank.
I'm scared of falling asleep.
I'm
not falling asleep.
If anybody drops
oh,
my
do you
face,
have Coke?
Like, no.
Do you have
coffee?
It.
Do you have coffee,
cappuccino, anything?
While the boys are scavenging for caffeine, the girls are hanging out at Claire's house. They're dancing on bunk beds and singing to their favorite Avril Lavigne song. The music's coming out of a pink Hello Kitty boombox.
All this time you were pretending so much for my happy ending.
The girls know there's a boy sleepover happening just down the street. They're dying to know what's going on over there.
Boys, they're boys, and girls are girls, so it's a totally different world. Boys are so into those,
video
you know,
games.
Video games and, like,
violence.
Oh, stuff but, like that.
Yep, that's pretty close. The video games, at least. And the boys, they think they've got the girls figured out.
They're probably all like, ooh, nail polish!
Not exactly. The girls don't seem to have much interest in makeup. They even seem confused when they find lip gloss in their goodie bags.
Okay, so maybe the boys don't have a clue, but they know they want to bother the girls, tear them away from whatever it is they're doing. Around 8 o'clock, they pick up the phone.
Hello? This is Bryce. We're the other sleepover and stuff. Can we, like, prank all the girls?
Why are you all telling right, them that we're pranking them?
It was the parent.
What did they say?
They said call back in 15 minutes.
Claire's dad lets the girls know what the boys are up to.
No!
We have to call them back. Who has their phone number?
They hit star 69. There's a lot of frantic passing the phone around as it rings.
Hello? Okay. This is actually a person from Philadelphia Music Choir. And I'm telling... Okay, never mind.
You guys are really bad prank callers.
Actually, they all are. Prank calling is about as primitive as you get when it comes to flirting, but none of them are able to play it cool enough to pull it off. The boys spend the next 3 hours doing things that come more naturally. They watch History of the World, they hog the PlayStation controllers, they call each other names.
You guys are retarded.
Your mom's retarded.
Your mom's mom is retarded.
Meanwhile, the girls dive into their goodie bags.
Sugar! I'm gonna eat candy.
And they play all kinds of games no one's ever written down the rules for. Zap, Mash, Winky, Blob.
A person gets picked to be Blob, and they have to put their sleeping bag over their head.
And then they have to find someone in the room and tackle them to the ground. It makes so much noise that Claire's dad comes upstairs.
Okay, guys, let's get into some sort of sleep position. Let's just turn the lights out and...
What if we have fun, but without you knowing?
That. Let's see if you can do that.
This is the moment the girls have been waiting for all night. It's when they go from regular old hanging out to having a sleepover. They lie down in their sleeping bags, huddle their heads together, and get ready for some serious bonding.
The boys also start doing things they wouldn't do with their parents around. They start cussing, and they decide it's okay to watch a violent TV show because it's claymation.
It's clay blood.
It's clay blood.
Anything goes. It is almost midnight. Sebastian's even counting down.
Saturday in like 30 seconds.
It's a new day.
I wonder if the boys are actually asleep.
They're not. Well, one of them is. Tyler's older than the rest of the boys by a couple years, and all night he's let them know it. He called them spazzes and said he doesn't even really do sleepovers anymore. But then he was the one to fall asleep first. For Bryce, it means it's time to follow through on his prank contract. He can't decide whether to use Colgate or Toms of Maine.
We're gonna put some toothpaste on his hand, get a feather, make him hit his
face with the toothpaste.
They sneak back to the couch where Tyler is sleeping and place about a week's worth of toothpaste on his hand. He doesn't slap his face, but the toothpaste gets all over his shirt.
That was good.
By the way, they went with Toms of Maine.
The girls want to stay up too. Not because they're afraid of each other, but because they want to connect. These hours with no threat of parents or little brothers barging in are sacred.
Life without sleepovers would be a disaster because it's like you'd have no time to tell your secrets and you'd be holding in all these things and like...
You like hold it in and it's like you start to feel like droopy and lousy.
And like some things you're a little scared to tell your parents.
Things like crushes. Mimi's mom doesn't think she talks about boys yet, but she's the one who brings it up.
Ashley, who do you like?
Okay, hang on. The girls made me swear, no telling who we like on the radio.
You could learn to like him. I mean, you used to like him. So you could just go back then. Think of all the good things you thought about him. Then you two could go out and you could get access. Access to things like boy sleepovers, what they talk about.
Hate to break it to you, girls. While you're busy getting close, the boys are falling apart. They're spread out on couches across the room and barely saying anything to each other. Bryce is driven to playing a round of sorry.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Against himself. Bryce eventually goes to sleep, so there's no more pranking to be afraid of. But the last two kids stay awake anyhow and watch Simpsons episodes they've already seen.
Yeah. After this episode, I might fall asleep.
Is there a point at which it stops making sense to stay up?
Yeah. We've done it before and we sleptwalked the next day.
Yeah.
It was terrible.
Tomorrow's going to be terrible too. It's 2:30 by the time they give in.
The girls are also losing steam.
Ashley.
Finally, the last girl seems to have given up. She's hugging one of Claire's toys, a ball that lights up when you squeeze it. It glows green through the fabric of her sleeping bag.
He was a boy, she was a girl. Can I make it any more obvious? He was a punk, she did ballet. What more can I say?
So Jonathan and Hillary brought us that story 2 years ago, and they recently sat down with one of the boys and one of the girls from that piece, Bryce and Mimi. Bryce is 14, Mimi is 12. She's the girl who wanted access to what boys talk about at their sleepover. So does she understand boys any better now than she did then?
I still don't have a clue.
Do you guys feel like there will be a time in your lives when you won't be as confused as you are now?
Yeah, definitely. And we'll grow older, we'll find more stuff out, we'll get married, whatever.
I think that I'm never gonna know completely. Like, I feel like a guy will always be confused about a girl and a girl will always be confused about a boy. And that they just, it's just the way it's supposed to be.
Do you feel that you're ever going to be too old to have sleepover parties?
Yeah, like not many adults really have sleepover parties. I mean, like college will probably be one of the last times you actually like are with someone like that, like because dorm rooms and stuff.
I think that definitely I won't have sleepovers for the rest of my life, but that it's going to be a long time until I don't have them. Because I think even if I was in the dorm room, it might be a sleepover every night, if I like them.
Mimi, I just remembered something that you did at the party. There was birthday cake, and you bashed your face into the cake, and we have a picture of it. Yeah. Is that something you would do now?
Yeah.
Is that the kind of thing that you only do at a sleepover party or that you do anytime?
Oh, just at a sleepover party. Because at a sleepover party, it's not like you get like a free ticket to do anything that you want to do, but it's more like you want to do things that you normally wouldn't want to do. So, like, I wouldn't want to do it at someone's wedding.
That was actually a question we had, right? Was what's the difference between a sleepover and just regular old hanging out?
I don't really think it's different. It's just sleepovers longer. And if they sleep over at my house, I usually have to clean up all the stuff they leave afterwards.
Mimi, is that sad for you to hear that for boys, that there's not really a difference between sleepovers and just hanging out?
Not really, because it's their thing. It's not my thing. You know, they do what they do, and we do what we do.
Hillary Frank and Jonathan Menhivar with Bryce and Mimi. We have pictures of the girls' sleepover on our website, including one of Mimi smashing her face into a piece of cake, some others of girls in mid-prank call. These photos will break your heart. WeekendAmerica.org. A La Nina weather event may be developing, and with it, increased rainfall in the Ohio and Tennessee valleys, decreased rainfall in the south, and a whole lot of me blaming things on La Nina without really knowing what I'm talking about. For more weather and fun, here's Jeannie Yandel.
Buffalo burgers, buffalo chili, and carved buffalo. The people of Prestonburg, Kentucky call it Buffalo Night. The buffalo of Prestonburg call it hell. All you can eat buffalo buffet, obviously, and cowboy campfire songs. Snowy and 16, so at least the buffalo that didn't flee Prestonburg can enjoy watching people shiver as they try to have supper. My mom can't stand Elvis Presley's music. So, Mom, if you're listening, stay away from Seattle. It's the Elvis Invitationals. More than 30 Elvi are gyrating their hips and hummin' their way through the King's Songbook. 44 and rainy, so hopefully those rhinestone jumpsuits are waterproof. First prize winner Elvis gets to follow my mom around, singing Hunka Hunka Burnin' Love. Real-life pirates do nasty things like hijack ships and rob people, but Oklahoma City points out that storybook pirates just want to dance. Cut a rug with Blackbeard at the Masked Pirate Ball. Cloudy and 25 for belly dancers, food, and mermaids. Wait a second, mermaids at a ball? Mermaids can't dance. Are mermaids just supposed to sit there on their fins while pirates have all the fun? Maybe storybook pirates are jerks too. For more information on these and other events, go to WeekendAmerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm Jeannie Yandel for Weekend America.
Everyone enjoys a nice hug. But can a hug provide more than comfort? Can it bring a spiritual awakening? Get real close to the radio next on Weekend America. From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. As you may know, Weekend America is going off the air soon. Our last show will be next week. As we wind things down, we're going back into the vault to play some of our favorite stories, a sort of a hug goodbye to all of you before we go. This next story involves hugging, lots of it, actual hugging. It's about a woman named Amma, known as the Hugging Saint of India. She goes around the world hugging people, several thousand a day. A day as a form of prayer. Hindus consider her a holy woman. She's known for her humanitarian work with orphans, prostitutes, and tsunami refugees. But she's most famous for the hugs, which she's shared with something like 20 million people over the last 20 years. A couple of years ago, she was in the San Francisco Bay Area, and Weekend America's Chrissy Clark got in line for a hug.
It's already dark when I pull into the retreat center that Amma's visiting. The hugging's going on up a hill in a converted barn. And as I walk up there, I can't see much, but I can hear it. Speakers and closed-circuit TVs blast her devotional songs into the cold night air. It smells faintly of outhouses and incense. Inside the hall, I literally have to climb over people to move. I finally spot Amma at the front. She sits on a low bench decorated with flowers and candy and gold and purple pillows. She's small and round. Her white robes are smudged here and there with the lipstick and eyeshadow of those who've already hugged her. Little kids cling to her. She doesn't speak much English, but she communicates with her big, throaty laugh. The crowd is an odd mix, mostly white hippies and Indian software engineers from Silicon Valley. A lot of them bring their kids. I meet artists and musicians, a planetary light healer from Canada, an insurance broker from Dallas, a paratransit driver, a woman in sales. They all line up to hug Amma.
It feels like a blackness is being sucked from me.
And you just kind of sink into it and don't want to leave.
It's like being a still pond, and her touch is like a small stone being thrown into that pond.
Magic.
We all have different ways we like to hug. You've got your bear hug, your man hug. But when you hug Amma, you follow her lead. First, you get a ticket, like at a deli counter. When your number comes up, you show it to a couple very serious-looking women in white, kind of hugging bouncers. They usher you onto your knees, and you shuffle ahead. Then two of Amma's helpers take hold of your shoulders and push you toward her bosom.
And it's so quick, I didn't even see her.
Roya Rahimi is a social worker from Philadelphia. She got her first hug from Amma 5 years ago. Now Roya's lost track of how many hugs she's had.
In fact, I had to sort of train myself the first few times going like, okay, look at her when you go up there, because I'd be like, did she hug me? What just happened? Because it sort of was in and out.
Some people blush after the hug. Some cry. Some put back on their watches. When Roya got her first hug, she just stood off to the side for a moment.
And all of a sudden, I could just feel this incredible stillness come over me.
After the hug?
Yes. That I just had no desire for language. You know, I kept running into people I knew, and I would just smile. And then it just grew and grew and grew and grew for a few days.
I get to ask Amma a few questions before we hug. She motions to a man she calls Swami, her translator. I ask why she hugs.
The question is like asking the river, why do you flow? So here what happens is a real meeting. You know, all over the world, you know, meetings take place. Professionals meet, politicians meet. But here, a real meeting, a real heart-to-heart meeting takes place.
I should mention that while she talked to me, she hugged at least seven people. It was like a hugging assembly line. She was a great multitasker. And then it was time for the hug. She looked at me and laughed. She wrapped her arms around my neck and pulled my head under her chin. She felt big and warm. She smelled like rose water. What was she saying? No? Was I doing something wrong? I started to wonder who was going to pull back first. But before I finished the thought, the hug was over. She slipped a Hershey's kiss and a red apple into my hands.
I feel dizzy.
Sit down, relax.
I sat down. My glasses were all fogged up. It was a nice hug, but not the best I'd ever had. I started overthinking it. Had I surrendered to her enough? Had I let myself become a still pond? Didn't she seem a little distracted? Amma hugged people from about 9 p.m. to 4 in the morning, probably about 3,000, for 5 to 20 seconds apiece. I left around 2:30 in the morning. On my way out, I ran into a man at the chai stand who was still beaming from his hug. I was still puzzling over mine. So I asked him.
Are you a hugger in the rest of your life? Do you hug much?
People that are close to me, but not strangers.
You're not
why,
the...
Why do you want to hug?
Well, you know, it's like once it sort of is in the air, you think, like, why don't I hug everybody all the
time?
True.
That's true. Well, if I like that, I'd go to Grateful Dead concerts, but...
But you don't.
No, I don't.
And then he hugged me. And it was a really good hug.
Have a good night.
Thanks.
Chrissy Clark in Castro Valley, California. Chrissy found out later that Amma was actually chanting Mamma Mamma Ma. It was a call to pure and divine love to lead and guide Chrissy, which is nice. At the end, Amma whispered in broken English, "Darling daughter." This weekend, Amma is on tour in India, hugging thousands of people in the city of Madurai. You can get a photo of Chrissy and Amma hugging. Chrissy's wearing headphones. It's at weekendamerica.org. And that's it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. Our program is produced with Ben Adair, Sasha Oslanian, Julia Barton, Hillary Frank, Michael Raphael, also Chrissy Clark, Brendan Noonan, Michael May, Ocean Kalen, Ariel Kitch, Angela Kim, and Chris Wieg, and Sam Keenan, Rob Byers, and Mark Sanchez, who Minnesotans can catch in concert this weekend. They're playing the Rock the Cradle event in Minneapolis. It's a rock concert for kids. Good luck to them. Many of the rest of us will be there watching. Come up and say hello. I'm the big Norwegian-looking guy. Actually, that might be kind of hard to spot in Minnesota. Our theme music was created by Galactic. Our executive producer is Peter Clowney. Jim Russell created the show. I'm John Moe. Tune in next week for the final Weekend America. It'll be like the final episode of MASH, but not as poignant. Or the final Seinfeld, but funny. Bye now.
This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
Hi, this is John Moe, host of Weekend America. The weekends are for sweet reminiscences.
What I decided was that I would never have a favorite song and that instead I would hate all music forever.
You know, I don't like Hall & Oates anymore. That's how much I did not enjoy that situation.
We're making new memories, so you can go ahead and forget those old ones. Join us for the next Weekend America.